just stared up at the sky, and then at the focus of the whirling mandala of little folk, at the kneeling formation of warriors, awaiting my word. They all stared at me. Mab's eyes glittered with fierce, bright pride. I didn't really know what else to do, so I just got to work. I dropped to one knee to address my little fighters, like a football captain in a huddle. I pointed at the body of the dead assassin squid and said, "See those things?" Toot growled, and the guard followed suit. It was kind of adorable. "The bad guys are sending those things to kill the big people trying to protect the pizza," I said. "They fly, and they're under a veil. We need your help. Only the little folk can protect us against them. I want a cohort stationed here and at the Svartov embassy to intercept any of these creatures coming in. Everyone else should hunt them down wherever they can be found. The littlest of your folk can help us by watching out for veils. If they see any bad guys moving around under veils or being sneaky, they should swarm them and make sure the big folk can see them and fight them."
"Kill these things,"
Toot said, gesturing at the fallen assassin squid.
"Guard this house and the Svartov house, and point out any sneaky bad guys to the poor, stupid biggins."
"Exactly, General," I said. "Can you do it?" Toot shot to his feet and up to my eye level, and the rest of the guard came with him. He shouldered his lance and slammed a little fist over his heart, making the fey metal chime again, and whirled to begin giving orders. He pointed and gesticulated wildly, speaking in too rapid and high-pitched a tone for my poor biggin ears to clearly understand. Individual members of the guard sped out into the night, up to the cloud of little folk above, to gather a constellation of glowing lights around them and speed off in different directions. Within minutes, the effects could be seen. Clouds of determined little folk, too small to fight individually, would zip around darting assassin squid in little swarms, creating streaks of light across the sky. When the first one was sighted, Toot himself zipped out with his lance gripped tight, Lacuna on his wing. Within a moment, the pair of them flew a dead squid back to the roof and dropped it proudly at my feet. Their armor and lances were stained with ichor, their little faces satisfied and proud.
"Like that?"
Toot asked. "Good work, General," I said firmly. "Carry on until we've driven them all away or the battle is lost."
"We will not lose the pizza,"
Toot Toot said grimly. Lacuna sighed. Then the pair of them zipped off into the night.
"Impressive," the red cap said once they were gone. He glanced at his pistol with a faint expression of disappointment and then slid it into his waistband at the small of his back. "How did you manage to bind them all?"
"Trade secrets," I said. I tried not to think about how much pizza it would take to pay off that many of the little folk. Maybe I'd send Marcone the bill. It was technically his stupid territory we were defending.
"I'm done with you."
The red cap narrowed his eyes, but nodded at me politely and went back over to Molly, who had returned to running her own communications through her own little folk crew. Mab approached and stood beside me for a moment, looking out at the night. You could see a squid being taken down every minute or so. It was a bit like watching for falling stars at the right time of year.
"Mortals ask a question," she said after a moment. "Is it better to be feared or loved?"
"I can guess your answer," I said.
"And I yours.
Yet they do not love you, per se," she mused.
"Not exactly, no," I said. "But I found something they did love. Something that united them."
Mab looked at me blankly.
"When a group comes together around something they love," I said, "it changes things. It changes how they see one another. It becomes a community, something greater than the sum of its parts."
Mab did not seem enlightened. I tried to explain another way. "The creation of the community encourages investment in that community," I said. "Once they've invested, they'll fight to protect it." Mab's eyebrows went up in comprehension.
"Ah, you found a weakness in their psychology and manipulated it. You provided them with a resource and incurred their debt.
I made them see themselves differently.
Neuromancy? You? I shudder to think of the results of that.
I sighed. Look, maybe you'll just have to trust me. It's a mortal thing.
Mab said dismissively. Still, an impressive display. You frightened several very confident beings tonight. I found it entertaining.
Yeah, it just sort of happened, I said. I leaned tiredly on the battlements. I wished I had a sandwich. I sneezed out of nowhere, so hard that I nearly slammed my head into the Merlin I was leaning on. By this time, I was getting used to it. I felt the surge of wearying energy leave me, felt where the conjuration point drew matter from the Never-Never into the mortal world and shaped it. I managed to get my hands into the air above my head in time to deflect a falling club sandwich. It bounced off one of my forearms, splattered partly on one shoulder and partly on the ground, before promptly turning to gooey ectoplasm. Mab stared at me as though I'd just begun dissecting a fetal pig at the dinner table. She shook her head slowly once and said, "Just as you begin to impress me." "Oh, bite me," I muttered and fished out a handkerchief to blow my nose. Stupid conjuritis. I was exhaling when the first explosion thudded through the night air. Everyone froze. To the east and a little south of us, a column of flames rose into the air, flaring out in the night. The shock wave of the explosion was tangible, even where we stood on the roof, something I felt push through my chest. "What's that?" I breathed. Mab drew herself upright, cold light gathering around her brow in a coronet of glittering motes that trailed a veil of tiny snowflakes behind it. Every eye on the roof turned to her as the Queen of Air and Darkness lifted her face to the night sky and spoke in a voice that did not so much thunder through the air as glide into the earth itself and resonate in gentle music from every solid surface in sight.
"Accorded nations," Mab said calmly. "Stand to arms. Mortal men of Chicago, remain in the homes that offer you your only safety. The enemy has come for the city."
Chapter 8. My stomach did a little twisty flip. Somewhere in my head I'd been processing it all night. That events this large could not go by unnoticed. Destruction on this scale simply could not be brushed under the rug, that this many witnesses could not be silenced. Whatever happened in the battle, whoever prevailed, one fact was clear. Things were going to change. The mortal world couldn't take something like this in stride. I'd known that on an instinctual level for a while, I thought. But I hadn't consciously processed it until I'd heard Mab addressing the mortal population of Chicago by means entirely and self-evidently magical. She wasn't even trying to keep things subtle. God, that had the potential to be the greatest nightmare I could imagine. The mortal world turned against the supernatural. The war that would be born from that conflict would redefine barbarism. And it could already be lurching into motion right here in front of my eyes. Of course, if Ethneu had her way, it was an absolute certainty. So we'd have to stop her here and now, and as quickly as freaking possible. But whatever happened, after tonight there would be walls coming down between the mortal world and the supernatural one that had stood solidly for centuries. Stars and stones. I didn't think anyone knew what that might mean. Focus, Harry. Save the city. Stop the Titan. Don't mess it up. While I was busy trying to screw my courage to the sticking place, Mab was already moving. She spoke quietly to listens to wind, and the two had a brief exchange before the old shaman inclined his head to her, murmured to Wild Bill, and then simply leaned and fell off the ledge of the building and out of sight. A heartbeat later,
The gliding, silent form of a great owl swept up from below the battlements and soared in the direction of the explosion. Out in the distance, I heard the sound of gunfire. Not the usual stuff, the kind of thing you might hear from time to time, that could maybe be a car backfiring. This sounded like a war movie, a crackling like deadly popcorn. Mab listened to the gunfire for a moment, then she stopped outside Martha Liberty's circle, speaking quietly, and listened to what one of the poppets had to say. From there, she stopped in with Lara Wraith, holding a brief conversation that featured several nods from each of them. Ebenezer stumped over to stand next to me. There was a long moment of strained silence. Then he cleared his throat and said, "How you doing, Hoss?" "I feel like I should be moving," I said. "Explosion, gunfire." I nodded in the direction in which Listens to Wind had vanished. "I should be running toward that." The old man grunted. "Do you remember the hardest lesson of power?" "Knowing when not to use it?" "Aye," he said, his voice rough. He leaned on a Merlin and stared out at the night. Firelight from a circle of road flares several blocks away reflected in his spectacles. He watched the little folk take down another assassin squid. "Well, in this fight, you've got to be in the right place at the right time. That means hanging back until you know where to throw your weight." I clenched my fists. He was right. I knew that. That didn't mean I had to like it. "I hate it, Hoss," he said in a very quiet voice. I turned to him and listened. "Seeing you like this all the time, in the worst of the crossfire, it was like this with your mother, getting more and more isolated from other wizards." He glowered at Lara and Mab. "Getting caught up with a bad crowd. And I didn't know what the hell to do, what to say to her, either." He coughed and blinked his eyes. "Damn it, Hoss. You keep getting hurt, and I can't stop it." I might have blinked my eyes once or twice, too. Then I leaned on the Merlin beside him and said, "Well, could be that I get myself involved in things sometimes." His eyes wrinkled at the corners. "You don't know how to sit things out, and that's a fact. Maybe I should have had a better teacher." He puffed out of breath and glowered at me briefly. "Wise ass." I sighed. "You think I've made the wrong calls. I think I don't know anyone who gets into bed with Mab without regretting it," the old man said, without any heat. "You're keeping real dangerous company, Hoss." "She's played pretty straight with me so far," I said. "Aye, and it's making you lower your guard, like it's supposed to." He shook his head. "She's immortal. She can take her time and tangle you one strand of web at a time, you and your apprentice, too." I thought about Molly's eyes, or maybe not Molly's eyes, cat-pupiled and alien. "It's dangerous," I said. "I know that. I went in with my eyes open. If Mab compromises my free will, she loses what makes me an effective weapon. It's still me, sir." The old man glanced at me from under his shaggy silver brows. His voice softened slightly. "You're betting an awful lot on that," he said. "Am I wrong?" I asked. His jaw muscles tensed and relaxed several times. "There's fallen from grace," he said finally. "And there's being pushed. And you're standing pretty far out on a ledge, Hoss." "My choice," I said, eyes open. The old man snorted. "Aye, don't mean I gotta like it." "Neither do I," I said candidly, "but it's what I've got." His eyes glittered brightly behind his spectacles as he stared at Mab. "You should get out." "Not without Molly," I said. He sighed. "Why do you think Mab roped her in, boy?" "Not without Molly," I said, in exactly the same tone. "Damn it," he said, but he stopped pressing. "Her next move will be to start putting the nails in. get you pegged down the way she wants.
Like what?
God almighty knows, boy. Responsibility, maybe. God knows you collect enough of that. She could use wealth to weigh you down, if you cared about that kind of thing much. Power, maybe. Influence. Maybe she'd throw some honey on top. But whatever it is, it'll look good at first glance, and it'll put you on a tighter leash.
Sir, I said, how well does history suggest that leashes will work out with me? For anybody at all. He snorted quietly.
Mab ain't a high school gym teacher, Hoss. Or a batch of worried, cautious old fools. He coughed. Or a worn-out farmer who cares too much about you.
I put my hand on his shoulder and squeezed. He nodded at me.
You understand, he said. I'm going to do what I think is right for you, Hoss. I have to. How can I do any less?
You're a stubborn old pain in the ass, sir. I said warmly and sadly. Who ought to know better?
Well, I was never much good at learning my own lessons, he said.
Another explosion happened, only to the other side, farther north. This one was softer and broader somehow. It didn't go kapow so much as it went woomph. Light flared out and showed us the shadows of buildings in a city block for a quarter of a minute. Though we couldn't see the source of the light. My stomach quivered again, uneasiness going through me. Fire. Gunshots continued. We weren't close enough to hear any screams. Not yet. My heart started beating faster.
Gas tank went up, maybe, I said. My throat felt tight, my voice came out scratchy.
Aye, agreed the old man. He eyed me. Then, without a word, reached a hand into his overall pocket and came out with a flask. He offered it to me. I opened it and sniffed, then sipped. Water. I wetted my whistle gratefully.
That came from up by the Svartalf embassy, I said.
He grunted.
Etri and his Svartalfs are set up in that area. He and the Archive are commanding from there.
Ivy, huh? I asked.
Thought she was neutral.
She was. Till Ethneu included her in her threat with the rest of us, Ebenezer said. The Archive realizes the need for self-preservation, and if the Titan truly wishes to subjugate humanity, she must destroy literacy as part of the process.
It's not so much that, I think, I said thoughtfully.
The old man looked at me. I shrugged.
Ivy, she's on our side, on the side of people, on a fundamental level.
How do you figure?
She's made to record and preserve knowledge, I said. No people, no knowledge. Nothing to record and preserve, and no reason to record or preserve it. Her existential purpose requires us.
Wouldn't get my hopes up too far about that one, Ebenezer said. But you might be onto something.
The red cap must have vanished from the rooftop for a while. Because I saw him come back up from below with a big black nylon equipment bag. He took it over to Molly, who looked up, waved away several of the little folk playing messenger around her, and rose to her feet. She took the bag from him, carried it over to us, and tossed it down at my feet.
There, she said. She eyed me. I'm just not feeling the suit for this kind of work. Go change. I arched an eyebrow at her. Then I leaned down and opened the bag. It had my stuff in it, from the apartment. A pair of jeans, a t-shirt, and my ensorcelled leather duster. My gun belt was there, too, with my big old monster-shooting revolver, as well as a short-barreled coach gun in a scabbard on a bandolier, loaded with various colored shells.
Suit up, Sir Knight, Molly said and winked at me.
Hell's bells, I muttered. I'm just a great big Ken doll for you people to dress up, aren't I?
You're lucky the Lenanshi is commanding the outer defenses, Molly said. Auntie Lei would have insisted you be properly attired.
Her smile faded. Her eyes searched for words for a moment, and when she spoke, she was choosing them carefully.
Harry, I won't be here for you tonight.
I paused and stared at her.
What?
Why?
I can't tell you, she grimaced, frustration in her eyes for a moment. But it's necessary, and it's got to be me.
I took a deep breath. I'd been counting on having the grasshopper to back me up, the now immortal grasshopper, for crying out loud. On the other hand, this was Molly. I stared at her eyes for a while. She and I had taken each other's measure already, and what I had seen in her was a dark and terrible potential, power that could be used for weal or woe based upon her choices. I guess the real question was whether it was really Molly making the choices any longer, if it was still the young woman I'd known. I knew where I stood on that one. If my Molly said she had to leave, she had a damn good reason. Okay, I said. I winked at her. I mean, damn it, but okay. She lifted both her eyebrows in surprise for a moment. Then she clasped my hands and gave me a brief, luminous smile. She nodded to Ebenezer and turned away, beckoning with a finger and collecting the red cap like a well-trained hound. The pair of them hurried from the command center and vanished below, presumably to leave the castle. And I felt a little more alone than I had a moment before. My stomach wasn't quite cramping, but the tension was getting higher. The quivering unrest inside me would not cease. We stood there waiting and doing nothing while a war began around us. Another car went up, this time farther to the south. An assassin squid made it all the way to the roof before Lacuna rammed her spear through it and pinned it to the map table 6 inches from Vatarung's hand. The one-eyed man grunted without looking up from the map, unstuck the spear absently, flicked the squid over the side of the building, and offered the weapon back to the small fey. Wizard Christos came over, looking dignified and severe in his suit and robes, and spoke quietly in Ebenezer's ear. The old man nodded, thumped my shoulder with his fist, and walked off to one corner of the rooftop, speaking quietly to the other senior councilman. I couldn't stand there doing nothing, all by myself. I grabbed the nylon bag and took it down to the locker room next to the gym. Then I started doing what you do in locker rooms and changed clothes. It was a busy place. The Einherjarn, who were still coming in from the blacked-out city surrounding the castle, would rush in to suit up and arm themselves from the weapons locker. I was down to my underwear when a man the size of a small polar bear slammed his locker and departed, still buckling a vambrace onto one arm, and abruptly left me alone in the locker bay with Gentleman John Marcone. The robber baron of Chicago had undressed down to his undershirt and slacks, and was currently fastening the fittings on a vest of overlapping scales of some advanced-looking material that covered his torso closely enough to be custom-fit. I'd seen him out of a suit only once before, and he'd been in rough shape at the time. Despite his age, Marcone was built like a light heavyweight boxer. The muscles moving under his forearms were made of lean steel cable. As I watched, he shrugged into his suit shirt and began buttoning it up.
"Did you forget the next step in the dressing process, Dresden?" he asked without looking up at me. "Or is this some sort of awkward sexual reconnaissance?"
With massive dignity, I put on my pants one leg at a time.
"Locker room talk, really?" "It seemed something you would be capable of appreciating."
I snorted and kept getting dressed. Marcone put on a gun belt and hung a pistol under each arm.
"I saw you earlier," I said, "facing Ethneu."
He eyed me without actually looking at me. The words tasted bitter and tainted in my mouth, but I said,
"That took guts."
His mouth twisted at one corner.
"Ouch, that must have hurt."
I nodded and spat into a trash can.
"No idea."
Marcone took up his suit jacket and shrugged into it. He adjusted it until the cloth fell without revealing the guns.
"Do you know the difference between courage and foolhardiness, Dresden?"
"Any insurance adjuster would say no."
He waved a hand at my banter, as though that was all the acknowledgement it deserved. Hindsight, he said. Until the extended consequences of any action are known, it is both courageous and foolish, and neither. Well, I said, tonight you earned yourself a Schrodinger's medal, I guess. He seemed to muse on that for a moment. Yes, he said, fastening one button. I suppose I did. He paused and glanced at me. I notice you kept quiet. Maybe I'm finally learning my lesson. That's not it. Marcone tilted his head, frowning. The only way that would have happened is, frankly, if you had not been present. Okay, well, sometimes even the bad guys are right, more or less. I kept my mouth shut and finished getting dressed. Dresden, Marcone said, while I have enjoyed working with your queen and find her business practices admirable, do not presume any sort of personal amity between us at all. Oh, I don't. Excellent, Marcone said. Then I will not need to explain how severely I will be obliged to react to you should you engage in any of your typical shenanigans in violation of my territory or my sovereign rights under the Accords. Really? I said. Right now? You're comparing testosterone size? I have no intention of dying tonight, Dresden, Marcone said, nor of losing what I have fought to claim. I am a survivor. As, improbably, are you. He nodded to me politely and spoke in a very quiet, reasonable tone that was all the more chilling for the absolute granite rumbling beneath the surface. I only wish you to be aware that I mean to continue as I have begun. After tonight, I will still be here, and you, by God, will show respect. Or what? I asked him, lightly. Marcon's stare was not a matter for lightness. I will pursue my rights under Mab's Accords, and she will not protect you. I felt a little cold chill go through my guts, way down low. Marcone had me dead to rights there. I had violated his territory under the Accords more than once. He just never wanted to shove it in the face of the White Council, who would have had no interest in bowing to a lesser power. Offhand, I wasn't sure what the penalty would be for that kind of law-breaking, but Mab's idea of justice wasn't exactly a progressive one. More to the point, her idea of justice was damn near an absolute. If I had broken her laws, I would deserve to be punished under them. My status as the Winter Knight would not matter to her in the least, except that she might be that much more annoyed before she executed me. Damn it, Thomas. Why in the hell do you get me into messes like this? As long as we're being honest, I said, you should probably know that I still think you're a prick. I still think you're responsible for a lot of good people getting hurt, and I'm going to tear you down one day. Marcone stared hard at me for a moment. He wasn't afraid of my eyes. He'd taken my measure, too, and I remembered the cold, fearless core of him. Of an apex predator who happened to wear a human form. And he, too, did something eerie. He smiled. A wolf would have been jealous. Excellent, he said. Then he left. I walked back out onto the roof, the heat of the summer night wet and heavy against my face. My duster hung heavy over my shoulders, too hot for the night. The spell-infused leather, a comforting weight around me. I gripped my staff in my left hand. From one hip hung my big 50-caliber revolver, the scabbard for the short coach gun loaded with dragon's breath rounds hung from the other. My warden's cloak was fastened over one shoulder, where it would be adding the least to my discomfort in the sultry air, yet still declare my allegiance to the council. Over on the eastern edge of the roof, Mab, Lara, the senior council, Vaderung, the Earl King, and the summer lady had gathered together in a silent group, with River Shoulders looming over them in the back.
They were staring out at the night, now lit by more fires, and the wind coming off the lake brought us the distant scent of burning rubber and black smoke. I looked down at the shadow being cast in front of me, the long, billowing outline of the duster, the slender length of my staff, the outline of my head with my ears sticking out a little, my hair a mussed mess. I'd been doing this for a while. The duster and the staff and the attitude. I mean, you'd think I'd have grown up at some point. But I was, in a lot of ways, still that dumb kid opening up his own private investigation business all those years ago. Across the roof stood some of the greatest monsters, legends, even gods of our world. They were staring out at the night, standing together. They were frightened. Underneath the calm, the steady action, the relentless calculation, the superhuman power, they were frightened. Them. And I was just me. I took a deep breath. My sneakers squeaked as I paced across the roof and joined them. The Earl King nodded to me as I stopped by his elbow. "They're moving now," he reported. He nodded out toward the original explosion. "Hear that?" The gunfire had increased to a frantic pace. Heavier ordnance was going off from time to time. Maybe grenades or something. I wasn't all that familiar with the practicalities of military weapons in action. The Earl King directed my attention to the north and south. "There, that dark space. That's where my troops are. They're forcing the Fomor to move around them to the north and south. See the fires?" I looked. He was right. Fires had begun to burn in a path around the embattled position. "There's too many of them," I breathed. The Earl King nodded. "For the time being, do not be distracted. This battle is not about Korb or his forces. It is about Ethneu." "Right," I said, watching the fires spread through my city, lighting more and more of it, and bringing with them a pall of smoke. "Right. Be cool." My stomach hurt, and I realized dimly that somewhere deep down, I was furious. Foes had come to harm my neighbors, my city, my home. There could be no fires too hot to devour them. And I was just standing there, doing nothing. My knuckles ached as I gripped my staff. "Contact!" shouted one of the Einarjaran. Without hesitation, Vadarung pointed at another of the Eternal Soldiers standing near him. The man lifted one of those grenade launchers with the big cylinder like a giant revolver to his shoulder and aimed it up. He fired three times. Foot, foot, foot. And within a few seconds, a number of flares were falling from high above, showering light onto the neighborhood around the castle. There were bipedal forms out there, shadows, really, stalking down the streets, sidewalks, yards, moving stealthily, freezing in place where the light fell on them, while the shapes moving in the deeper shadows seemed to become that much more furtive and agitated.
"Ready, stations," called Marcone's voice. "Prepare to fire."
I turned to see the Baron of Chicago walk briskly onto the roof, flanked by Guard and Hendricks. He ignored me as he walked past to stand beside Vadarung. "An assault force."
"Light infantry, I think, Baron," Vadarung said, squinting his eye out at the night. "They're forward elements, scouts. They haven't shown us their strength yet."
Marcone nodded.
"Hold fire unless the enemy engages us," he said to the nearest of the Einarjaran and one of the tallest.
The man nodded and passed the order down the line.
"Wait," I said. "What?"
From down the street, my street, I heard the sound of shattering glass. Someone screamed. I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. It was high-pitched and desperate. The human voice rang out surprisingly loud in the stillness of the night. That was a person, terrified. Someone who lived on my street. I heard the frantic panic fire from a pistol, maybe someone's revolver. A scream, something that sounded too harsh and brassy to be human. There was a long, drawn-out howl, then a flash of light, and I saw something red and flickering hit a car about 100 yards down the street. There was a breathless quarter second, and then a car went up in a fireball as its gas tank exploded. I could see figures, furry or fur-clad, rushing toward the open front doors of one of a row of rental houses. There were few supernaturally significant thresholds to speak of on such properties, little protection from the powers of darkness. My stomach twisted in fear and rage. Every instinct in my body urged me forward. The predator's territoriality within the winter night's mantle was in complete accord. The need for violence, to defend my territory, to rend my foes, pulsing through my veins with every heartbeat. There, I said, and pointed a shaking hand. We have to help them. That is not our role in this fight, said Bannerung. Another scream came down the street. This time, there was no mistaking it. It was a child's voice. A single, high-pitched note. Hoss, said Ebenezer warningly. I couldn't see. My vision was narrowing to a tunnel. My chest heaved. I looked to my left. In the tunnel of my vision, Mab was a slender, pale white light, her eyes bright, feline, narrowed. She watched me. We have to help them, I said, louder and harder. Mab's teeth showed. We can't, Ebenezer said. Hoss, there's too many of them. We can't commit until we know. I stared around the rooftop. Then I said, to hell with all of you. And I did something I've been working every day for months not to do. I let the winter mantle do its thing. I went off the roof in a leap, windmilling my arms and legs. I hit the ground, let my body break my fall at its natural bending points, dropped into a forward roll, and came up running, moving as quick and sure as any creature of the wild. There was a heavy thud, and 1,000 pounds of river shoulders landed next to me, an eager growl bubbling in his chest that sounded freaking tectonic. Ahead of me, another car exploded, part of a fireball catching one end of the rental house and enveloping it in flames. Indistinct, inhuman figures leapt in through the front door. And me and a genuine, honest-to-God Bigfoot let out simultaneous roars of rage, one way more impressive than the other, and launched ourselves at the invaders. Chapter 9. I caught their scent at about 60 feet. It was a wild, fierce smell, something that hit my hindbrain and set the hairs all along my spine up straight. Ever smelled a predator's den? There's a musk of the creature's odor mixed in with the scent of urine, a little bit of rotten meat, and the faint sweetness of marrow with the rasping dryness of cracked bone. That same predator reek hit me as we closed in on the invaders. Figures with massive, fur-outlined bodies and gnarled, muscular limbs. I got a good look at the first of them as we hit the sidewalk outside the embattled home. It looked almost human. Skin the color of wet ashes, 6.5 feet tall, maybe, with the lean, ropey muscle of someone who can cover a lot of ground in a hurry. Its hair was a mane, ferocious and long, with feathers and claws bound in among it. The horns of a stag either grew from its skull or had been bound there somehow. A heavy mantle of furs over a long cloak of the same gave its lean torso some kind of protection, and it carried a long spear of some blackened metal in its hands. Even as we closed, the creature had whirled toward us, bringing the tip of the spear up. There was a low howling sound, and a flicker of reddish light gathered around the creature's hands. The light flashed up the shaft of the spear, hitting a number of pictographs etched into the metal along the way, each exploding in a sequential flash. I had about enough time to realize that a projectile was coming my way, and then the tip of the spear glared scarlet, and I flung myself to the side. There was a shrieking, howling sound, and a chunk of asphalt, half the size of a garbage can, flew up into a spray of scorched, blobby, flaming road material 10 yards behind me. I hit the ground at a roll, tried to come up running, and tripped on the damned warden's cape. I half strangled myself and fell. River's shoulders had me covered. Even as the creature's spear tracked toward me, the Sasquatch simply took a bounding stride, lowered a shoulder the size of an off-road tire, and ran into the thing. If the creature had been standing in front of a train, it might have been better off. About half a ton of supernaturally powerful muscle hit the creature in a concentrated burst of precisely aimed energy, as focused and directed as that of any martial artist. The creature's body went ragdoll, flying back from the impact in an explosive crackling of breaking bone, only to hit a large old oak standing stolidly in the house's front yard, despite severe trimming to allow for power lines. The shape that fell to the ground at the base of the tree was kind of amorphous. River's shoulders turned toward the front of the house and let out a roar that literally shattered the first floor windows, a primal scream, and, the winter mantle told me, a challenge that could not be ignored, not by foes as primally bound as these. There was a faint sound to one side, and my eyes snapped forward to see a second of the creatures, this one larger and better muscled than the first, ease around the corner of the house, outside of River's shoulder's view, and raise its spear to aim at the Sasquatch's back. I drew without thinking, from a prostrated position, tightening my abs and aiming slightly to the right of my right foot. I had a great sight picture and lined up the dots of the big 50-caliber revolver and squeezed the trigger without once thinking a single thought. The bullet went through the creature's right cheekbone, holy crap, and came out somewhere behind where its right ear would have been. And the thing whirled toward me, shrieking in fury, lips peeling back from a row of nightmare needle teeth, and leapt at me, its black spear lashing toward me. Hell's bells. That should have been terrifying. But the winter mantle didn't really do fear. Instead, I felt myself noting that the thing was damn stupid to leap in the air and go ballistic like that. Had it come toward me, low to the ground, serpentine, I might have had a hard time shooting it, since it could have changed direction unpredictably. Up in the air like that, it was at the mercy of Newtonian physics, and it was a simple matter to predict where it would be at any given time. I put the second round through the upper neck at 10 feet and rolled to the side. It crashed heavily to the grass where I'd been, and kind of flopped onto the sidewalk in front of the house, twitching in hideous spasms and making gurgling sounds as it died. I came to my feet, regained my staff, and staggered as River's shoulder's scream was answered by multiple throats from inside the house. Brassy cries that could not possibly be entirely human ones. Wooden window frames and pieces of glass that still hung in them exploded outward from the house as somewhere between 6 and 10 creatures came screaming out at us. We had apparently been fighting the skinny little ones so far because these things must have massed 20% more than either of the first two and looked taller and stronger to boot.
"Dresden, these are huntsmen. Kill them quickly,"
River shouted. He bounded toward a figure as it came screaming out the front door of the house. One of his huge hands slapped the head of the huntsman's spear aside. The other seized the huntsman's furry neck and squeezed. Imagine a toddler having fun with his banana. It was like that, but redder.
"I don't know what that means,"
I screamed. I barely had time to clear my shield bracelet and raise a shield before three of them opened up on me with a howling, flaming thunder of those black spears. Fire and force enveloped my shield and made the air hot and too full of smoke and choking gas to breathe. I had to stagger back out of it. The huntsmen didn't let being blinded by a cloud of smoke slow them down. Those spears howled and sent concussive force and fire splashing against my shield, or missing me completely, and hitting the houses across the street. River came sailing through the air and landed behind my shield in a crouch to be able to keep his head at the same level as mine. He dropped something messy out of his right hand, the huntsman's gray corpse minus its head.
"Look," he said.
I did. Right before my eyes, the corpse withered and shrank away. deflating, as if it had been a skin filled with air. I could sense energy rushing out of it, something moving almost too quickly to be sensed at all. And the other huntsman screamed again in primal fury, louder.
Each that falls gives its strength to its packmates, River Shoulders snarled. Quickly!
He turned to one side and leapt, 50 freaking feet in a single bound, both huge fists coming down on a huntsman better than 7 feet tall. He didn't strike twice. When River Shoulders hit something, it went down, and it stayed there. Without slowing, he bounded forward into the smoke, even as the pack howled again. A huntsman emerged from the smoke and leapt over my shield like it was on wires. I kept the shield held out toward its pack mates back in the smoke, tracked it with the big Smith & Wesson, and started pulling the trigger as it landed and whirled with its spear. The first round hit it center mass, and the big, slow bullet staggered it, even if it didn't make it blink. It snarled and thrust its spear at me, but I'd gained enough time to shoot again, and before it could commit its weight to the thrust, the second round hit it lower and must have gotten its spine because it dropped limp to the ground, and sank the fingers of one hand into the dirt and drove the spear at my face with the other, screaming. I ducked and slapped the head of the spear with the barrel of the revolver, throwing up sparks. Then I recovered my aim and sent my last round through its forehead from 5 feet away. Its head snapped back and then flopped limply into the dust, its body already desiccating and draining away. And the pack screamed, louder, deeper, harder. I holstered the gun and darted to one side, dropping the shield and trying not to gag and choke in the smoke. I tripped over a bundle of furs and loose skin, the remains of a huntsman that River had apparently gotten. I recovered my balance in time to see a freaking icon of a huntsman, nearly a foot taller than me and rippling with muscle, emerge from the smoke, whirling its heavy metal spear like it was a parade marshal's baton and swinging it at my head. There was no blocking that kind of force. It would have shattered my staff if I'd tried. I ducked and backpedaled and barely sensed the second huntsman close in on my flank in time to fling myself out of the way. Its spear came down close enough to slice through the bottom hem of one of the legs of my jeans and to leave a cut in the side of the sole of my shoe. Two more huntsmen emerged from the smoke, enormous and terrifying. One hefted its black spear and hurled it at me. The other simply lunged, hands outstretched, filthy nails like talons spreading wide. The spear hit me in the left shoulder. When its tip met the ensorcelled leather of my duster, there was a sudden shower of sparks as the energies in the weapon and the garment met and clashed. The impact was vicious, like getting slugged with a weighted bat, and it spun me to one side in an explosion of neutral white noise sensation that the winter mantle substituted for pain. One of the huntsmen flung itself at me in a human spear attack and hit me in the right bicep. Right about the same time, the one with the bad nails came flying at me from not quite the opposite angle, only it hit me in the shins and went down hard. There was an explosion of sensation that would have left me stunned and breathless without the winter mantle's influence. As it was, I kept enough awareness to twist on the way down and keep from getting any broken bones. And once I'd hit, kept my breath, drew in my will, and shouted,
"Repellere!"
Naked, unseen force exploded out of me in a half-sphere, a wave of thick, heavy energy that lifted the huntsmen from their feet and flung them a dozen feet back through the air. They twisted and bent in graceful arcs as they went, and every damn one of them landed on all fours like some kind of big, ugly cat. I was on my feet by the time they were, but my shoulder wasn't working so good. I was pretty sure it had been dislocated. One of the huntsmen made a sound like a wild boar, and the others moved, clearing to one side as it lowered its spear and readied another blast. I crossed through the coach gun from its scabbard, thumbed back the hammers as I raised it, and let him have it with both barrels of dragon's breath. Dragon's breath is a specialty shotgun ammunition. It normally consists mainly of hard pellets of magnesium. But Molly's people had added white phosphorus into these rounds. Twin fireballs bellowed from the coach gun, and splattered the top half of the lead huntsman in a cloud of white-hot pellets of burning magnesium and white phosphorus. The burning metal didn't stop burning just because it had been buried deep in the thing's flesh, and the huntsman and a 5-foot circle of grass around it burst into flames, sending up a squealing scream from the creature that felt like it could burst my eardrums. It thrashed horribly, staggering in a small circle before falling to its hands and knees. I dropped the coach gun, turned toward the other three, and started to bring up my shield again. But one of them had rolled a higher initiative this round, and a little horn-handled knife tumbled past the hem of my duster and sank into my thigh. Agony seared through me as if the knife had been white-hot. Pain had been a long absent visitor in my daily experience, and its sudden arrival sucked the wind out of my lungs. Fire pierced my leg like a bar of red-hot metal. I could feel it searing me to the very marrow of my bones. At the same time, my shoulder exploded in silver threads of nerve-rending torment as my rotator cuff screamed in protest at the damage. Iron. The bane of the Fae and their magics. The winter mantle screamed. I staggered and fell to a knee as I seized the bone handle of the little knife and wrenched it out of my leg, just in time to catch a stomping kick to the sternum that knocked me back in a short, brutal arc to the ground. Stars exploded in my vision, and something in my head felt loose and hot. The breath was gone from my lungs. I tried to gather my will again, but they piled onto me, tearing with nails and biting, for crying out loud. And then there was the sound of a dinosaur's footsteps shaking the ground, and River's shoulders tackled all three of them, sweeping them into the circle of arms thicker than a horse's neck, and squeezed. There was a quick series of wet, crunching sounds. River stood up with a contemptuous shake of his arms and dropped the huntsman. What was left was sort of smushed together. Ever seen the thing? Think in that direction, only more slippery. With the little knife gone from my flesh, the winter mantle recovered itself pretty rapidly. I took a couple of breaths and then pushed myself to my feet, the pain once more vanishing into a vague haze. That was the great weakness of the Fae, their bane. And mine, I suppose. Iron. Wow, that it hurt. How many? River demanded. How many did you kill? 3, I said. You? 9, he said. Well, okay then. Smoke. Rivers spat in the tone of a swear. We missed one. What? I said. There are always 13. The burning corpse in the smushed ones abruptly deflated. And there was a sudden crashing sound as a huntsman, half a head taller than Rivers' shoulders, just shrugged its way through the front wall of the house, taking maybe half the front of the house down. It raised its spear and let out a bestial roar that would have set off car alarms had any of them been working. It leapt toward River's shoulders, its heavy iron spear held in one hand like an assegai, and thrust it at the Sasquatch. River took a pair of quick pivoting steps that I'd seen Murphy do before, guiding the spear's tip past him with one hand and getting in close to the huntsman where he could seize the weapon's haft and try to wrench it from his foe. The huntsman roared its defiance and fought. The heavy iron bent and snapped like cheap plastic before the application of that much raw physical power. The huntsman promptly rammed the snapped end of the spear in its hand into River's shoulder's neck. If River had been human, the blow would have killed him. But the Sasquatch had layers of muscle mounded up around his neck. His trapezius muscles went all the way to the bottom of his ears, and the shard of the weapon was ineffective at penetrating that much meat. Even so, the huntsman got its other arm around River's shoulder's waist and lifted the Sasquatch off the ground, charging forward to ram him into the old tree. I lunged, seized the 13th huntsman's leg in both arms, summoned my will, and screamed, "Arctis!" Cold, the pure supernatural cold of true winter, flooded out of my hands and into the huntsman. There was a horrible crackling sound as the temperature of the flesh I was touching sank to single digits on the Kelvin scale. The huntsman shrieked in pain and kicked its leg in an attempt to dislodge me. I hung on. There was a crackling sound, and I took the leg from the knee down with me. The huntsman screamed and fell in a shower of ice chips and a gout of blood. Without hesitating an instant, River's shoulders seized the frame of the sedan in the driveway, picked it up with a tectonic knotting of massive muscles, swung it overhead like a man using a sledgehammer, and brought the engine block down on top of the 13th Huntsman in a massive swing. Though it was crushed flat, there was still a horrible vitality in the Huntsman. It let out a burbling, hissing sound that somehow conveyed the same impotent fury as a shriek. And then it spasmed and died. The car rocked and snapped and groaned in the Huntsman's death throes. I pushed the frozen leg away from me and slowly got to my feet. I'd lost my staff at some point. I recovered it. While I did that, River pulled the iron bar from his neck. He let it fall by the last Huntsman. The body began deflating just like the others, and as it went, the shard of the iron spear crumbled with it. What? I breathed. In the hell was that? River poked the spear. Welsh creatures, the huntsmen of the land of the dead. Whole pack makes their spears from their blended blood over the years, forges them together. He shook his head. Bad news, very bad. These things are the scouts, I demanded. That's not fair. We heard bestial screams coming from the east and south. Hell's bells, I muttered. I coughed, gagging on the smoke. There was enough of it. More houses were on fire now. People were running out. Come on, we can't leave them out here. I strode up to the door of the house, shield bracelet raised and ready. Someone had been shooting here, after all. I didn't plan on getting cooked by some panicked normie. Hello, the house, I said. My name is Dresden. I used to live down the block in Mrs. Spunklecreef's old place. There was a pause. Then a male voice with a Hispanic accent asked, with a dog? Yeah, I said. The big gray dog. Mouse, the man said. I could never remember actually doing more than waving at this guy as I went past. I was pretty sure I hadn't ever introduced my dog. How did he know Mouse's name? Damn, Pooch is more of a people person than I'll ever be. There was a clattering sound, and then a slim, medium-height man in his late 30s emerged from the back room of the house. Behind him came a woman who matched him well, and a little girl holding a stuffed animal of some indeterminate but well-loved kind. It is you, he said. Hey, man, I said, lifting my chin. Things are crazy, huh? He stared out at the night and the flames and the smoke and at the remains on his front lawn. He nodded numbly. Okay, I said. Come on, I need your help. We're going to get all these people into the castle they built at the old place. There are people sitting on their asses there with nothing better to do than protect you guys, okay? The man looked numbly at the street, then at me. There was shock happening. He stared for a blank second and then nodded jerkily. Castle. Get everyone in the castle. And hurry, I said. Oh, and never mind the Sasquatch. He's with me. Kay, said my neighbor. Just roll with it, I said. Get them rounded up. Go. He staggered toward a man who had emerged from the house across the street and was watching it burn. The two talked, then grabbed another neighbor. People started getting herded toward the castle. Come on, I said, before Marcone does something stupid. I strode forward back to the castle, several yards ahead of the first stragglers to stumble that way. I marched up to the base of the wall where everyone had been observing things and shouted, Marcone! There was a muttered conversation above. Marcone leaned out and peered down at me a moment later. What? These people need shelter, I said. Let them in. Marcone glowered at me. His pale green eyes tracked past me to the stragglers coming in. I am not a charitable organization, he replied. You want to be Lord of Chicago? I spat, contempt in my voice. Talk is cheap.
act like it.
Up on the wall, I saw Mab put a hand on Marcone's arm in restraint and say something. Marcone locked eyes with Mab. Then he simply looked at her hand and arched an eyebrow. Mab withdrew it, her eyes narrowed. Marcone inclined his head to her in a small bow and turned back to me. More huntsmen let out shrieks. They were not in the distance. More of those howling blasts from their spears lanced through the night. I heard someone else scream, maybe a couple of blocks away.
"Damn it, man!"
I snarled. Marcone leaned an elbow on the Merlin and considered me for a moment. Then the people again. He nodded his chin once.
"Talk is cheap," he confirmed. "Send them in."
I blinked. Marcone glared out at the smoking, howl-haunted, firelit night and clenched his jaw. The granite of the castle seemed less substantial.
"Hendrix, guard, with me."
Then the Lord of Chicago spun on his heel and went to see his people. Chapter 10.
So I and River Shoulders and the Einherjarin and Marcone's troubleshooters started clearing the way for people to get to the castle. There were a number of short, vicious clashes with the enemy's huntsmen, and Marcone's people acquitted themselves like professionals, which is to say that the fight never even came close to being fair. Even so, they had a couple of their people taken out with injuries, and the foe just kept coming. Until one of the Einherjar matter-of-factly started hanging up the flapping, empty skins of the fallen foe across the street on a ghastly, improvised clothesline. Once that gruesome warning marker was up on the street surrounding the castle, the foe started giving the area a wider berth. Marcone got snipers onto the rooftops to handle anything that approached along the street, and they taught the enemy to keep back. It was all accomplished pretty much by the numbers. Of course, I noted that was the point of sending out disposable light troops to attack the city, have them go everywhere, causing havoc until someone started killing them. Then all Ethneu would have to do would be to go to wherever the bodies were piling up and engage the enemy. Or she could avoid those areas and wreak havoc unopposed, throwing more and more troops between her and us while she smashed the place. It was a bloody price to pay for a map of the town's defenses. Apparently, they thought they could afford it. The Earl King himself came down to oversee the downing of the last towering huntsman. A couple of the largest Einherjarin fought the thing with 6-foot claymores and made a bloody mess of the street, laughing uproariously the entire time. I'm not kidding, laughing. The freaking Eternal Soldiers were having a ball tonight. That poor lunkhead Lara had left unconscious in the basement was missing Viking Christmas. "So what's the name of the place the huntsmen are from again?" I asked.
"Anuvin," River Shoulders said. "Welsh land of the dead, ruled by Auron once upon a time. But the Tiwatha settled his hash back in the day, just like Ethneu did poor Gwyn Ap Nudd."
I had picked up one of the black metal spears. They felt cold and greasy to the touch, and just holding one made my joints ache a little. They quivered with a kind of stone-flake primitive enchantment that had been shaped into them with hours of throbbing drumbeat and primal screams. Some kind of iron alloy. I think the damn thing runs on hate. That's how you shoot it. You just have to hate hard enough.
"Seems about right," River Shoulders rumbled.
He had one hand wrapped around my forearm, my entire freaking forearm, gently. The other was braced against my chest. My entire chest.
"Okay, on three."
"One," he said, and he put my arm back into its socket. There was an explosion of static, and then a bunch of the white noise cleared away. River's shoulders released me carefully and arched an eyebrow. I tried my shoulder. It functioned much more smoothly, and I nodded my thanks at him.
"Yes,"
agreed the Earl King, turning from the last throes of the fallen huntsman. "It makes them easy to lure forward and impossible to drive away." He paused to nudge the deflated remains of a huntsman with the toe of one boot.
It is not possible to contain more than a handful of such creatures for any length of time. The enemy has been breeding this batch up of late.
I grimaced.
Yeah, they've been taking people since the Red Court fell.
Now we know why, River's shoulders said.
Wait, I said, feeling sick. They breed more of these things from people, or they make more of them from people?
The process is somewhat distasteful, began the Earl King.
Wait, I said again. Stop, just stop. I don't want to know.
This, he said, will not be the worst of it.
Cheerful, I said. He shrugged, hunting leathers creaking.
Incoming, he noted calmly.
A great gray owl swooped quickly down from the night air, back-winged in a thunder of feathers, and landed in a heap. The heap kind of quivered and then resolved itself into the shape of listens to wind. The old man shimmied his shoulders a little, then winced and rolled one arm while grasping at his shoulder with the other hand.
Need to do more yoga,
the old man muttered with a grimace.
Hey, River. Mobility routines are important for a human your age, River Shoulders said, his tone clearly worried.
Listens to Wind broke out into a boyish grin that took a couple of centuries off the old man's weathered face.
Ain't been your apprentice for a long time now, Tonka. Never listened when you were.
What of the enemy? The Earl King asked. Our boy's getting hit pretty hard, Listens to Wind said. They got these gorilla squid things.
Octokongs, I interjected. Everyone stopped to eye me. Hey, it's important to have specific language, isn't it? I complained.
I went to all the trouble of giving them a usable nomenclature.
And, River Shoulders rumbled, you named them octagons, huh?
It fits, I said.
Fits, Listens to Wind acknowledged.
Goofy looking, right?
I said.
Goofy looking, and they carry rifles and crawl on the sides of buildings, Listens to Wind replied. Hell of an advantage in a city. Things can't shoot much, but if you get enough of them, they don't have to be good. Plus, some teams of them fellas in turtlenecks are back there providing fire support. They're sniping at anyone with a radio, trying to kill communications.
That'll be listen, I said. King turtleneck. Way I hear it, the enemy got good help.
Annoying when they do that, the Earl King noted. About time we thought about going to help our people, if we're going to go at all, the old man said. They'll get cut off soon.
The Earl King nodded sharply and started walking.
Let us tell One Eye.
Listens to Wind fell into pace beside the Earl King, who paused and then added sotto voce.
If we go without him, you know how he gets. A lot of guys like that got control issues, the old man opined. To be expected.
Kringle suits him better, the Earl King muttered.
Kringle would suit anyone better, even you.
The Earl King looked shocked. The two of them vanished back into the castle. The fire team of Einherjarin went by, escorting a stunned-looking group of civilians inside, where they would be waved through by the various sentries to the castle's interior. Out in the night, there was a constant background of crackling gunfire and shrieks and the howling screams of those dark metal spears like the one I held, at least until it started flaking and turning to rust right in front of my eyes. There was more ambient light now, and more smoke. Chicago was burning.
How many can we fit in there, do you think? River's Shoulders asked me.
Well, they aren't exactly worrying about fire codes right now, I said. Maybe 300 or 400 if we pack them in.
How many of your people in this city?
8 million, all told, I said heavily, give or take.
Not much difference, he said.
I pointed at a couple of half-dressed parents with half a dozen kids in various stages of pajamas, hurrying inside the squatting stone solidity of the castle.
Makes a pretty big difference to them.
The Sasquatch flashed a sudden, very wide, very white grin. It might have been charming from a safe distance. From right there, it was imposing as hell.
Yes, he said, that's right.
Stars and stones, River, I said, I'm glad you're on my side.
Means you've got good taste, the Sasquatch said.
Besides, you stood with me when I needed it.
Yeah, I said. Those situations weren't ever exactly of this magnitude. Be kind of a lousy friend, I counted the beans between us that close, the Sasquatch said. I blinked at that. Friend, huh? Helped me with my kid, River's shoulders said. With family. You've been my friend. Now it's my turn. Again he showed me that terrifying smile. Besides, he's kind of fun, huh? I started to sputter, but instead I found myself just grinning back at him. Taking out a bunch of monsters and saving a bunch of people had damn right been fun. Terrifying and nightmare-inducing and fun and right. Hell's bells, it felt good to be doing something I knew was right. I held up a fist. He eyed me for a moment, and he made a fist and carefully bumped knuckles with me. The shock of it threatened to dislocate my shoulder again. But being all manly, I didn't make any high-pitched noises or anything, and you can't prove otherwise. The battle was a hell of a thing. I could hear it happening around me. I could still smell blood and death. I knew it was going on, but here, where we were strong, the enemy was keeping his distance for the time being. Occasionally, one of the snipers would fire a shot, generally to the sound of squealing screams in the distance. I wanted to be fighting, but that battle with the huntsman had convinced me that charging out there all blind and righteous would probably get me killed within half a dozen blocks or so at best. Even with River Shoulders next to me, that had been a close one. What if a second pack had crushed in during that? Maybe it would have been my skin hanging up on a clothesline, and the plan to stop Ethneu would officially be over. I checked the coach gun. I'd recovered it and my revolver. I reloaded the trusty hog leg and strapped it back on. Dragon's breath rounds were rough on the weapons you fired them through, but the coach gun was as solid and simple a piece of American steel as you could find, and the barrels were short enough to make eventual heat warping a non-issue. It would serve me a while, yet. I reloaded the weapon with a couple more dragon's breath shells and slid it into its scabbard. There was a tromp of boots from the castle, and then Marcone came out, flanked by guard and Hendrix, and trailed by a column of heavily armed and armored Einherjarin, who immediately assembled in the street. A dozen ghouls came gambling into the night after them, transformed into their half-bestial state, and armed and armored from the castle's stores, blades and guns, mail and Kevlar, as they had chosen. They immediately loped into the night toward the lake, muzzles wide, tongues lolling and drooling. Our scouts. Yick. Lara came out next, dressed in a loose-fitting white garment of some kind, trailed by Riley and half a dozen of his professional shooters and another half dozen members of House Wraith, which is to say, a sort of dizzying vision of dark-haired and pale-skinned women who wore the same loose-fitting white garments, moved like leopards, and carried a variety of instruments of death. Lara went by with a glance and a smirk, and she and her people ghosted out into the shadows as our vanguard. The White Council emerged last. Ebenezer, Listens to Wind, and Christos, backed up by Ramirez and his squad, all in gray cloaks now, staves in hand, weapons strapped, ready for action. The old man headed straight for me, and I rose to meet them.
Okay, Hoss, he said. Remember, we've got three positions between here and the lake.
Yeah, I said.
Well, we're heading for the opening between the northernmost two, he said. And Etri and his people, along with the Summer Lady and the rest of her gang, are heading for the gap on the south side. The idea is to force the Fomor to a stop so they have to bring up their heavy troops if they want to advance.
I frowned. I thought the idea was to wait until Ethneu revealed herself. The old man grimaced. If we don't stop the advance, he said, the battle won't get that far. It won't need to. She'll have won already. He shook his head. We have to force her to use the eye to get through us. If they've got that many troops, I said, why should she? She can just grind us away. She doesn't have time, the old man said, his eyes glinting. Mortal emergency response systems are already in motion. The National Guard is already mobilizing and on its way.
They've got to bring up heavy equipment to clear the roads so they can get through, but they'll be here by dawn, maybe sooner.
So, I clarified, finding myself grinning irrationally, we're going to charge into the meat grinder as fast as we can to force her to hit us as hard as she can, and then hope we can punch her lights out before the army gets here and starts killing everybody in sight.
We, Ebenezer sighed.
Aye, fair enough.
Yippee, I said. That sounds like fun.
Rumbled River Shoulders. The White Council suddenly looked very cautious to be standing in the proximity of the Sasquatch's rumbling laugh.
Well, I said to River Shoulders,
shall we?
My grandfather lifted his eyebrows.
Sure,
River Shoulders said, and climbed to his feet, lightly for all his enormity.
Be good fun. Bigfoot versus Octokongs.
What?
Asked Christos, his handsome face confused.
You heard him, I said.
Let's go. Chapter 11. So we moved out, into the smoke and the dark and the chaos, and the enemy did what the enemy always does. They showed up without calling ahead and screwed with our nice plan. We'd marched down to Montrose and turned east, heading down the streets at a trot. I found myself moving next to Ramirez, who grimaced and clenched his jaw and kept the pace with silent, pained determination until we got to Wells Park. The darkened buildings and looming shadows of the park could hold hundreds of enemies. We pulled up to wait for a moment while Lara's people swept the place. Ramirez found a bench and eased onto it, gasping. I knelt next to him. We watched as people, fleeing the chaos between here and the lake, paced silently past us, eyes wide and haunted. They crossed to the other side of the street as they approached and realized that we were a large, armed group. I didn't blame them. There was a goddamn Bigfoot standing on the corner, apparently examining a crosswalk pedestrian button in fascination. Chandler, Wild Bill, and Yoshimo joined us as a factor of natural gravity, and I watched Ramirez will the pain and weariness away before he addressed them.
So, Ramirez said without pausing, the enemy's northern arm came ashore at Montrose Beach. Lara's mercenaries are to the north of us in Uptown. They were holding the line at Lakeshore Drive, but they got pushed back to Sheridan. Marcone's people are down south of us, and they're dug in around Wrigley. They're holding. That's funneling the enemy right into the space in the middle as they try to get around them. McCoy and the senior council are going to stop them from doing that, and we're going to swat any flies that bother them while they do.
How's your leg there, boss?
Wild Bill asked casually.
I can't feel it, Ramirez lied. It'll last the night.
You are hurt, Yoshimo said.
That she had spoken at all was remarkable. Her Latin was flawless, her English only so-so, and she wasn't the chatty type.
It is not appropriate for you to be entering battle.
It is not ideal,
Ramirez agreed, still struggling to control his breathing.
But we need every hand on this one.
If this don't go so good and we have to skedaddle, Wild Bill said, you're gonna be a little slow, Poncho. It could get dicey.